Tracy Mears is a Central Illinois native and a Yale law professor, and she spent years investigating difficult questions about the interactions between police officers and the public. Plus, the UIC women's gymnastics team won a conference championship, but their program was still cut. We'll talk about that and how colleges prioritize certain sports. Also, caregivers for veterans are often under a lot of stress. A new study shows how mindfulness therapy can help.
The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media, airing on WILL in Urbana, WUIS in Springfield, WGLT in Normal, WNIJ in DeKalb, and WCBU in Peoria.
That's all coming up on this special encore edition of The 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo, and happy 4th of July. We hope you're having a safe and fun holiday weekend, whether you're on the road right now or with your friends and family. Coming up this hour, UIC has had a great gymnastics team, so athletes and fans were stunned when the university decided to cut the program. We'll also talk about how mindfulness can help people who care for veterans. But first, what do police and civilians want from their interactions with each other? That's one of the many questions at the heart of Tracy Mears' work. The Yale law professor has spent a lot of time in Illinois. She grew up in Champaign in Springfield and was a professor at the University of Chicago. I spoke with her right before Martin Luther King Jr. Day back in January when she was the keynote speaker at a MLK Memorial breakfast in Springfield. I started by asking her what's changed over the years when it comes to race and policing.
Well, if we're talking about how far we have come from the 1963, which was the year that Dr. Martin Luther King gave his I Have a Dream speech, I think it's fair to say that we've made substantial progress. He was living in a world in which police were actually used, especially by states in the South, as a mechanism to enforce legal segregation of the races. One only needs to look back to the infamous incidents on the Edmund Pettus Bridge to see, you know, what I'm talking about. But serious issues remain in terms of the relationship that policing agencies and police officers have with people of color and with people in their communities generally.
There's something you talk about, which is that for the past 30 years or so, police are seen as, they're sort of this warrior mindset. They're seen as people who fight or prevent crime. And I think that shapes all of our thinking when we think about policing, right? And I wonder what you think is missing from that.
I'm glad you mentioned that, because this idea that police could be a bulwark against crime and that their primary job was to reduce crime, which lends itself to this notion of police officers being warriors against crime, is a relatively new idea. If you look as recently as 1968, just a few years after Dr. King spoke on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial, people didn't really think that that was the job of police. They really didn't think that police could do much about crime. And it's not to say that people didn't think that it was important for police officers to respond to crime, to bring people to justice. But there's no necessary relationship between bringing offenders to justice and holding them accountable and crime reduction. And we don't live in that world anymore. Many people, political leaders, think that it's the job of their police executives to ensure that police officers go out and do something about crime and do something about crime in a particular way. A very particular mode of policing has become prevalent, and that is a mode in which police are sometimes very attentive to small, low-level offenses. What might come to mind is the incident in New York City in which Eric Garner was arrested for selling loose cigarettes, that means cigarettes outside of a packet, on the corner, and he lost his life. What people want, I think, is less about whether or not police seem to have this strong impact on crime, and what they want is for police to treat them fairly. And the research that I've done with my colleague Tom Tyler over the last several years shows that when people are understanding the fairness of their relationship to legal authorities, they focus much more on how they're treated by those authorities as opposed to the outcomes that those authorities produce.
So I wonder if you can help me explain a little bit more, Tracy, about this mindset, because I think a lot of people might be surprised to hear you say the things you say, and they say, well, police are there, their job is to stop crime. How did we used to think about what police officers should do or what their role should be in our community?
Yeah, I think what people used to think about what police do over time has changed. I mean, police have been around for, well, since the Civil War. I mean, there's a one conception of policing that says the job of a form of police, what's called slave patrols, is to bring back runaway slaves. Another conception of police in the turn of the 20th century was, in some urban areas, was to be part of a political machine and provide services to residents of neighborhoods at the direction of political bosses. And in the 70s, a primary conception of policing was to be rapid responders when called and not necessarily proactive. So some of what people think about policing today, of course, is just a function of what they are used to in their own lifetime. But let me say a little bit about what our research shows that people care about from police, but not just police, all kinds of legal authorities, whether you're talking about judges, or prosecutors, public authorities in general. Our research shows that people care about four things. They care about what we call voice, having a say, being listened to, having an opportunity to have input on policy, and in a particular interaction, let's say with the police officer, people want to tell their side of the story. And they want to do that even if telling their side of the story doesn't actually make a difference to the outcome of the decision making. Two, people care a lot about being treated with dignity and respect and concern for their rights. They want to be treated like someone who counts by a person in legal authority, and often that matters more to them than whether the outcome favors them or not, right? So think about getting a ticket. You can not get a ticket and be treated really poorly by a police officer, or you can get a ticket for speeding that you know you deserve and be treated with dignity and respect. Third, people care a lot about fair decision making, and by that, I mean people care about indicia of lack of bias. They want decision makers to be neutral, transparent. They want evidence that decisions are being made with reference to facts and not simply being told to do something because the person who is the decision maker says he or she has the power to do so. And then finally, people care a lot about being able to assess whether the motives of the decision maker that they're dealing with are trustworthy. That's the one that captures history and networks and explains often why groups of people who identify in a certain way may distrust certain kinds of authorities. If you are an African American who fled to the North from the South because of lynching and terrorism, sometimes aided and abetted by the police, when you get to the North, you're not necessarily going to trust the motives of the police that you deal with. And then when those people treat you poorly, you may then suggest to your friends, family, and children that, you know, these people who say they're here to serve and protect you, you have reason not to trust them.
So we've been talking about your research, but you've also been involved with this in practice as well. And that was in Chicago, and after the shooting of Laquan McDonald in 2014, police officer Jason Van Dyke was convicted of his murder. The city brought you in to help train with the Civilian Office of Police Accountability. What did you do there?
One of the things we talked about were the four factors of procedural justice and why that's important. We also engaged in exercises. We did some scenario-based training in which the potential investigators took a look at actual complaints that had been given, I think, to the prior organization before COPA. I forget the alphabet soup of what it was called then, and had the investigators diagnosed how the disposition of those complaints either did or did not comport with procedural justice principles. Would a person actually think that they were treated fairly if the disposition of that complaint was carried out in the way that the prior organization carried it out. And then the third step was to say, okay, now that you know what makes people feel better and have more trust in you and in your agency, what kinds of things should you actually do?
So you weren't speaking to police officers, but I wonder how you do this in an environment post Laquan McDonald, Jason Van Dyke, convicted of second-degree murder, a police officer of Laquan McDonald. How do, in the wake of not just that, but all, when we think about other shootings of Black men or boys who were killed because of or at the hands of police, I wonder how that trust happens. Not even if it's not even police officers, if it's other people, yeah, like investigators, when we're, yeah, thinking about this, and everybody comes under this rubric of community relations and law enforcement.
Yeah, so here's what I hear you asking me. One way of interpreting your question is, why would we think after this kind of an incident that simply training personnel in agencies like COPA or the Chicago Police Department, you know, training them to have a better understanding of how, of what it takes for the public to view them as legitimate, why should we think that that makes a difference? And I think an implication of that question is there's no reason to think that the levels of trust will change until police simply start acting differently. And I guess I would say that those two things are related. I mean, you know, I think it's true that, you know, there needs to be behavior change and the behavior needs to stop. And then there's a question of, well, how do we get there? I think one way of getting there is by training people to do better. We have some evidence that shows that the training does change certainly people's attitudes about their own understanding of what's fair. They place less emphasis on thinking that the most important aspect of their job is to arrest people, and they have a sense of this idea of how important procedural justice and legitimacy is. I think when you look across the country, that the most progressive police executives have an understanding of this, and they are taking seriously trainings such as the one that Tom Tyler and I developed with officers in the Chicago Police Department who are really dedicated to this proposition. But other things need to be done. I actually think that holding the officers who violate laws about taking people's lives should be prosecuted and held to account. And so it's very important that Jason Van Dyke actually was found guilty. So it's also incredibly important that agencies start taking seriously that they might need to focus on a different kind of person to be a police officer. And finally, and let me just say something that people don't often think about, police officers are workers too. And these ideas about procedural justice and legitimacy not only apply outside the office, that is, with respect to the ways in which officers treat the people outside of the office on the street, but it matters inside the office too. And we've got important research that shows that when the agencies themselves are not organized internally with procedural justice and legitimacy, it's very hard to expect the members of the force to treat people outside of the agency in that way.
Tracy, we started this conversation thinking about this day that we're honoring the life of Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and the civil rights movement of the 1960s. And we've also been talking really about present day. And I'm thinking a lot about the Black Lives Matter movement and how it is mostly shaped around relations between police officers and Black Americans. And many have compared their work to the civil rights movement of the 60s. And I'm curious where you see this movement today and how it's shaped our conversations around policing. What else do you think we need to be talking about?
Now, I think the movement for Black Lives is a critical aspect of this push for police reform. And while I do a great deal of work on the kind of nuts and bolts of reform instead of training, I try to do it in the context of a bigger theory about what it means for people to understand their relationship to legal authorities in terms of fairness. And that in itself is also critical to understanding the nature of citizenship itself. And if Dr. Martin Luther King was talking about anything, he was talking about ensuring that Black Americans had full citizenship rights in this country. When he spoke and gave his stirring words in 1963, that was in the midst of the Civil Rights Movement, which some folks have called the Second Reconstruction, because it was an attempt to fulfill the promise of the first Reconstructions that followed the legal abolition of slavery. But today, I think some leaders of the movement for Black Lives think that we still have work to do. And if you actually parse the speech that Dr. Martin Luther King made in 1963, he mentions more than once this issue of police brutality as an indicator of the lack of full civil rights and citizenship that Black people have. And I think that focusing on this issue gives us an opportunity to really think seriously about what we want the state to look like, not just in terms of police, because if we actually take back, you know, say, okay, the footprint of the police needs to be smaller, well, we need to do other things to make sure that people are safe that aren't just punitive. You know, we need to focus on good schools, and we need to focus on decent housing, and we need to focus on good jobs. And again, if one looks to the words of Martin Luther King, that's what he's talking about. So he gave us a blueprint, I think, for the third Reconstruction, and we have yet to fulfill it.
That's Tracy Mears, co-founding faculty director of the Justice Collaboratory at Yale Law School. Central Illinois native. Tracy, thank you for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thanks so much. I had so much fun.
Thanks for tuning in this 4th of July. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Coming up after the break, we'll continue this encore edition of the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome back to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo.
With a season high total of 195.45, your UIC Flame.
With that announcement, the University of Illinois at Chicago women's gymnastics team wrapped up their last home meet ever after 40 years of competition. Back in the first week of the fall semester, UIC announced it would be ending both its women's and men's gymnastics programs to the shock and disappointment of coaches and athletes. Despite the news, the UIC women went out with a bang, tying for first place as co-conference champions and missing a bid to regionals by just 1/100th of a point. Kate McGee reported on this for WBEZ Chicago. We talked about this with her back in March, and I started by asking how the athletes and coaches at UIC first found out this would be their final season.
So it was the first week of the fall semester in August last year, and they were at practice Thursday night, and all of them got an email saying to come to a meeting the next morning, and no one knew what was happening or what the email or what the meeting was going to be about. The coaches and students were a little confused, but they all showed up the next morning. The coaches were there a little bit earlier than the students, and the coaches got the news first that the 2018-2019 season would be the last one, that UIC was going to cut the program, and the students were told 30 minutes later that this was their last year as gymnasts at the school.
Wow. And so what were the students told, if any of them were on scholarship, about how that would work and those sorts of things, Kate?
So they want the ones with scholarships, which is not that many. The number of scholarships has declined over the years for the gymnastics program. They would be able to keep their scholarship through the remainder of their time at UIC, which was a good news for some of them. But many of them were not on scholarships. And in fact, on the men's team, two students actually immediately transferred to different schools to continue their gymnastics competition instead of staying at UIC. So it was kind of a mixed bag of emotions for a lot of the students, especially for the freshmen who had just gotten on campus 1 or 2 weeks prior to learning this news coming for the gymnastics program. I was told from all the students it was a very emotional and kind of heartbreaking meeting.
And to that point, one woman who wasn't in the room was senior Mickey Northern. She was diagnosed with thyroid cancer earlier that summer, and she was recovering from surgery when the meeting was held. And I wondered if we can play a little bit of audio from your reporting. This is UIC athlete Mickey Northern speaking to Kate McGee from WBEZ when she found out that the program was ending.
I reacted worse to the program getting shut down than I did to finding out that I had cancer, which is weird to most people, but it's like just because I've had surgeries in the past and I was like, you know, if this is what I have to do, then I can get past it. Like, this is something that was handed to me, like, I can work with it. But the program, I was like, I don't know what we can do. There were so many questions in the air.
That's WBEZ Chicago's reporting. Kate, wow. I mean, I think that probably really says it all in terms of her sentiments. I wonder, did you hear similar sentiments from other folks?
Definitely. I mean, I think everyone was completely shocked and heartbroken. You know, gymnastics is this very intensive sport where most students, many of these students have been competing or practicing since they were 3 or 4 years old, and you spend hours in a gym. Many of these students have had, like, it's not just the time commitment, it's the physical commitment. I mean, many of them have said that they were like 9 years old getting elbow surgery.
Yeah, I was going to say, I have people in my family who are doing this, and it's like 9-year-olds, 5 hours a day, and they're practicing.
Yeah, I think one student said that growing up, there was no gym near her house, so her grandmother would drive her 40 minutes one way just to go to practice every single day for 4 hours since she was like 4 years old. So they're, you know, physically, and they, like, I tweeted out, or I on Facebook when I shared this story, like, spending time with these women, I have never felt so lazy in my life, of like how athletic and impressive they are, and the things that they can do in the gym were just, it was amazing. And they would do them so casually, just kind of like flipping all over the place. It was really an enjoyable time to spend with them. So they were all, I mean, this is their lives, and they've really committed a lot of their life to this sport. And so being told not only that this would be their last season, but being told so suddenly, and many of them felt like there wasn't a really good explanation as to why. Many of them said to me, you know, I feel like my life's work has been ripped away from me without any kind of notice or explanation.
And so I want to get to that why in just a minute, Kate, but I wanted to just play some more audio. This is junior Maddie Nowak speaking to Kate about this.
Our goal this season is almost like normalcy. And to be honest, that's what it feels like every day in the gym. It doesn't feel like this is going to be my last season.
Hi, Maddie.
Honestly, it hits me most on those days where I have a good meet or if I have like a great practice, because those are the days I go home satisfied, yet disappointed, because I try to imagine myself at this point next year and realize that I most likely will not be competing.
That audio from WBEZ Chicago, we're speaking with reporter Kate McGee about the UIC women's and men's gymnastics programs that have now been cut. So, Kate, how did the season go for these athletes?
So the women's team did really well this season. They won 10 of their 12 regular season meets. And this is something that the coaches said that they weren't really surprised by, because they had been working and to recruit and really build a really strong team since for the past few years. And they actually had 2 years of recruiting classes already kind of lined up, and they were really looking forward to the future of this program. And so the students did really well. They made it, you know, tied for first in their conference championship this past weekend, and were really happy with how they were doing. They felt like they were coming together as a team and, you know, kind of uniting in the face of this really disappointing news. And so it was a really kind of athletically successful season for all of them.
Kate, you also had a chance to speak with longtime coaches who are a husband and wife duo, Mary and Peter Jansen. I wonder their reaction to all of this, too.
Yeah, so they have been there for about 30 years. They came in 1990. They were both actually at the University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign, and where Peter was coaching, and that's how they met there. And I think they would agree with me in that this was their baby, this team. Like, they had been there for so long. They built this team up over the years that when they got there, the team did not have a winning record. It was not a great sport wasn't doing well, and they brought the team to regionals 9 times over that year, over that time span. In the hallway at the gym at UIC, there are these huge kind of team photos going back decades, and so you can kind of see them kind of throughout their time kind of aging with the teams and how long they've been there and how much they've committed to this program. And since, you know, as I mentioned before, they found out that Friday morning with the students, and they were equally as shocked and heartbroken that this was going to be the last season for them, something that they had worked so hard to build.
So let's get to the why. Kate, we did reach out to UIC to try to get them to come on the 21st today. We did not hear back from them. What did you hear from them about, or what did you learn about why they chose to cut this program?
So I didn't hear a lot. They also would not talk to me for the story or answer written questions. They really would point only to this written announcement that they put out in August when they formally announced they were cutting gymnastics. And they've said very little about the decision publicly since then. Their argument basically is that they don't have the resources to provide a world-class kind of student-athlete experience for all the athletic programs at the school. And so they had outside consultants review the programs that they have, and they were actually weighing whether to cut track, swimming, or gymnastics. And this consultant report came down to that gymnastics would be the best program to cut because it cost the most money, and that money could be better used to improve the student-athlete experience for the rest of the program at UIC and to enhance the other athletic programs elsewhere. But beyond that consultant report that we got through a Freedom of Information request and the letter publicly that they sent out, they have said very little about how they came to this decision and why.
Let's bring someone else into this conversation. Dave Ridpath is also on the line with us. He's an associate professor of sports management at Ohio University, where he teaches about intercollegiate athletics. Hi, Dave. Thanks for being with us as well.
No, fantastic to be on. Thank you very much.
Dave, was you listening? You've been listening into this. Is this a surprising story for you to hear for the way that a college would cut a sports program?
Well, I mean, first off, sounds like, you know, excellent reporting, and it was fascinating listening to this, but also following this story. And I just had a smile on my face because it's the same thing, different school. And what you're seeing here, it's just it's so humorous when you hear essentially what I would call coded language. When you have a school like UIC saying, we want to provide a world-class experience for the rest of our athletes, what they're really saying is we want to try to get better in one or two sports. For a UIC, it means probably men's basketball, so we can somehow make ourselves a more prominent university, which is largely a myth that would even happen. And we're going to do that at the expense of other teams. What UIC can do, they can provide a UIC experience. They cannot provide a world-class experience. They cannot provide what Champaign-Urbana provides. They cannot provide what Northwestern provides. And they shouldn't try to be that, because trying to be that is what a lot of schools have tried to do all over this country. And Title IX is not an issue. When you talk about Title IX of balancing gender equity and finances and treatment, Title IX is not the issue. Dropping sports is a choice. In fact, most programs that you see in college athletics right now had dozens more programs back before all these TV contracts and other things. What we're doing now at schools like UIC is we're overpaying basketball coaches. We're giving some students an experience well beyond what they should be having as a UIC student, and trying to capitalize on this winner-take-all market of, is, oh my gosh, if we're the next Loyola of Chicago, that's going to be this huge panacea for the school.
Well, and right. I mean, there's no coincidence we're having this conversation during March Madness, Dave, right? So how much of this is a mentality with universities that they have to put everything into a sport because they think that's going to be the moneymaker? Is that kind of the prevailing mentality among collegiate sports right now?
I mean, that's exactly what's happening. You have what is called, again, largely a myth, the front porch theory. And you see things like Loyola and like Sister Jean last year, and schools think, oh my gosh, here's a small school that essentially, you know, caught lightning in a bottle, and congratulations to them. But even with the gains and everything that Loyola of Chicago maybe made, they gave their coach a huge raise, they've done all these things and facilities and other things, that's going to offset any gains maybe that they've gotten. But schools believe that athletics is the clearest and cleanest window that people see a university. And in some ways, there is some merit to that. But at the end of the day, it is not the main reason for a university to exist. And not everybody is going to have success like a Loyola, but all schools think that they should strive for that, so they put whatever resources they can. Spending on male sports, football and men's basketball, has gone up almost 500% since Title IX was started to be enforced in college athletics. So this is not a Title IX
right,
issue.
Right, so there are people who are listening thinking, oh, they're putting money into women's sports, that's why they had to cut this. But you're saying this that doesn't have anything to do with this, is what you're saying, Dave.
The bottom line is it's a choice, and the money is there if we choose to use it. And schools like UIC need to try to be UIC and stay in their lane and not try to be something they're not. But they get what I would call Loyola of Chicago envy, and they think that they can do it. And the ability to do that is really few and far between, and oftentimes it's a lot of luck to where it happens. And schools have to realize that they can't put all their eggs in one basket, because college athletics is supposed to be about participation, about the sound mind and body, and giving teams like gymnastics and others a chance. And the big worry is, as we continue to cut teams like this, this is the primary feeder system for our international teams, national teams, and other things like that. But as we continue just to focus on football and men's basketball, what's going to happen to the rest of sports development in America?
Dave, I also wanted to ask you just about the philosophy, just the counter to this, right, is you're saying college sports should be about the athlete. It should be about all of these other things you're talking about. But the money part of this is that a lot of universities feel like their fundraising and their ability to fundraise and their ability to especially fundraise from alumni is tied to men's basketball and men's football.
I think, again, that's largely a stretch. And what I would say is if we ran college athletics the way that it should be, the way that we claim the things that we supposedly care about, you know, the athlete going to class and learning and getting a degree and playing for good old State U, when it's really become a commercialized business about making a profit. Now, while alums and Subway alums, some people may really like it, those things would still happen if all the universities ran college athletics the way it was supposed to be. It's actually kind of this for-profit model that has put us in this area of where we want to win at all costs. And we don't care if the athletes can read or write. We don't care if they're getting bribed to go to that school. We just want to win.
Kate McGee has been with us as well from WBEZ Chicago, where she did this reporting about the UIC's women's gymnastics team, women's and men, the program now being cut. You also talked to other universities throughout Illinois. What were other coaches throughout Illinois saying about this and the team at UIC?
So at the last home meet, which was against Northern Illinois University, before the meet started, the Northern Illinois team came over to UIC's team and kind of said to them, almost in solidarity of like, we love you guys, we, you know, are rooting for you this season, and gave them flowers before the meet started, which I think a lot of the students were trying to hold their emotions in already, and that really like put them over the line and everyone was crying. And I think it was this symbol of like, the students really felt for the teams at UIC because they see college athletic budgets tighten and universities have tight budgets. And I think there was this sense from other athletes like, this could have been us. And so throughout the year on social media and at the meets, teams have worn UIC gear. The team at UIC started this social media campaign where they used this hashtag Flip the Decision. And if you go on Instagram, you can see all these videos that college gymnastics programs across the country have made their own videos in support of UIC, kind of pushing for the school to change their mind and reinstate gymnastics. And so, you know, gymnastics was, the students were kind of like, yeah, this is a gymnastics community, we're very close, everyone's really supportive. But it was really a sign to me that, you know, people felt, they felt for these students, and they know that, you know, next year it could be their program that gets cut for whatever reason. And so they wanted to show their support of gymnastics generally. There are only 60 Division I gymnastics program, college programs in the country right now, and that has gone down over the decades, and there are even fewer men's programs. So with each one that gets cut, there are fewer opportunities for students to kind of continue their gymnastics careers through college. And that's something I think they're all aware of.
That's Kate McGee. She's been following UIC's women's gymnastics team for WBEZ Chicago. We'll tweet out a link to her reporting and have it at our website as well. I also would like to thank David Ridpath for joining us. He's an associate professor of sports management at Ohio University. Kate, Dave, thanks for being with us.
You're welcome.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for listening to this 4th of July Encore edition of The 21st. Coming up after the break, we'll share a conversation I had about mindfulness and how that can help people who provide informal care for veterans. Stay tuned. Listening to a special edition of The 21st, I'm Nyla Boodoo. This year, it's estimated that more than 200,000 service members will return home, and they'll join the 18 million veterans already living in the U.S. What does care look like for those 18 million vets? According to the RAND Corporation, about 5.5 million of those veterans are helped primarily by informal caregivers. That could be a spouse, sibling, or child. It also means these people are balancing careers, relationships, and other responsibilities of their own while taking care of their loved ones. Now, a new study from researchers at the University of Illinois finds that mindfulness therapy can help alleviate some of that stress for caregivers. Kinesiology and community health professor Sandra Luz Lara Sinisomo is the lead author of this study. Sammy Anderson is a lawyer who also cares for her husband, who served in Iraq. We talked to them earlier, and I started by asking Sammy to tell us a little bit more about her husband, Garrett.
Garrett and I have been married almost 15 years. He was injured when we were actually married. I apologize. We'd been married 6 months when he was injured by an IED in Baghdad, Iraq. He suffered what we referred to as traumatic injuries. So they rebuilt half of his face. He lost one arm. He suffers from a traumatic brain injury. And so when he returned with these injuries, I was a six-month newly wife. Mm-hmm. And the Department of Defense said, here's your husband. Start taking care of him.
Yeah.
Almost immediately once he landed at Walter Reed.
And what did that look like? I wonder, in the beginning, what was it like? I mean, I imagine in the beginning, you're kind of just in this emergency mode of just, how can I take care of my husband?
Well, and I was 26, 27, and I had never experienced anything really traumatic like this. So physical injuries that look like this. So when I walked into his ICU room and he was in a coma, I wasn't really prepared. That's a shocking thing to walk into.
Yeah, how can anyone be prepared for that, right?
Right. And I had never taken care of anything, like plants even, just myself. So to be given this responsibility, it was pretty much I call a sink or drown method to where you figured it out. The Department of Defense, all those years ago, they didn't provide classes. There wasn't resources. There wasn't help. And there were significant amounts of injuries coming back from Iraq at that time. The hospital staff was actually overwhelmed.
Yeah, so this was 2005.
Correct.
I wonder if we can fast forward to today and ask, you know, you guys have kids.
You've
been married for more than 15 years at this point, right? What does a typical day look like now as you think about you balancing your career, your kids, your husband? What does the informal caregiving part of that look like for you?
We refer to it as controlled chaos because there's so much on our plates every day. And it will overflow to my children. So where Garrett lacks in his abilities, I make up for. If I'm not there, my 12-year-old makes up for. For example, his memory. So forgetting things, not remembering certain things that, you know, he may have to make a stop on the way to school for something. My 12-year-old, because I'm not in the car with him, she'll remind him. So it's a crazy kind of daily life, just trying to figure it out.
It sounds pretty stressful too.
It is. It is. So it's almost like you have to learn how to manage it. And I call it, you learn how to kind of stuff it in.
Mm. How would you say that stress, if we're thinking about just even the past couple of weeks, how do you think it affects you personally?
Well, after 15 years of caring for my husband and having kids and working, I had my first ever panic attack.
Mm.
And you could not have convinced me at the time that I was not dying. I literally thought I was having a heart attack. I argued with the ER physician, which, by the way, she was wonderful, that I'm dying. Go figure out why I'm dying. And so she had such an enormous amount of patience, but I had never had that. And she said, you've been living this way for 15 years. It's bound to happen.
Sammy, thanks for sharing that with us. I appreciate it. Sandra Luce, I wonder how often you hear stories like this. I imagine it's pretty common.
Yes. We're,
because we talk a lot about veterans, yes, but we don't necessarily talk about all the people who are there to help them.
Right. They have their own story. They have their own experiences. And like Sammy said, a lot of them don't have orientation to how to care for the veteran. The veteran comes with sometimes very complex health and mental health needs that then the informal, often a spouse or another family member, then has to manage and provide services that they aren't really prepared to provide, but must do so in the interest of the well-being of that individual and the family.
And so when you say in your research, you talk about a caregiver burden, these are the kind of things you're talking
about.
Yeah,
the things that Sammy also illustrated are really kind of this allostatic load, this buildup, this accumulation of stress that happens for the caregiver who has to manage multiple responsibilities over a long period of time with very little resources often, very little breaks. In our research, we found that most of our caregivers are doing it on their own. They just kind of endure it. But this is a mentality that we found in spouses of active service members. This is a committed family to begin with. And they're enduring and hardworking, and they're going to see it through one way or another. But it has consequences.
So how would you, I wonder before we even get into the whole idea of the mindfulness techniques that you were doing in your study, maybe you should explain a little bit about what you mean when you say mindfulness and how this can help people in stressful situations.
Yeah, so mindfulness is really, we talk about being more aware, being less judgmental. There are special skills that you learn, like what's called a body scan, paying attention to your whole body, thinking about your thoughts without reacting to them, having feelings, naming them and not judging them, observing your environment. And so it's really more of a self-awareness, less of autopilot, just react, more of, okay, what is happening? What am I feeling? How am I responding? What are the words that I can just use to describe those feelings?
And so how did this help caregivers, particularly of veterans?
Well, mindfulness helps you kind of slow down, calm down, pay attention. And in our exit interviews, one of the caregivers said that her husband noticed that she doesn't react as much to him, that she's calmer, and that that's helping him calm down. So through the training, the caregivers learned how to pay attention to their own thoughts, to their body, to their physical responses to a stressor or an aversive experience. And so they're taught to slow down, to name those experiences, and to reflect on them without feeling bad about them or feeling guilt.
Sandra Luce, how did you do that here with the study? Did you have people in a group that you taught these techniques to and then you surveyed them?
Yeah, so we enrolled 23 participants in the Champaign-Urbana and Danville area. They were randomly assigned to the intervention, which is an 8-week program for 2 hours a week. All the participants who were assigned to the intervention would come in. They'd get training by two very highly trained doctoral students who are trained in mindfulness and are very well versed in the technique. And so for 2 hours a week, they'd come in, learn, and then they'd go home and practice, and they had to log that practice. Now, we had a wait list that then we offered the intervention to as well, because we thought it would be ethically and responsible for us to do so.
Right, because what did you find? Because it sounds like you found that this was something that was really helpful for people.
Absolutely. We found that compared to the wait list control individuals, those people who had to wait the 8 weeks before they could access the services, that those in the mindfulness training reported significantly fewer stress symptoms. Anxiety and worry was significantly lower. In fact, we saw some of those symptoms go up in the waitlist group.
Mm. And so, Sammy, I imagine this would be something that would be really helpful for you, it sounds like.
Right, it would be. I mean, just going back to what I had talked about with the panic attack, what triggered it for me is because I had a medical emergency and was told I couldn't go to work for a week, that's what triggered it. I mean, who gets a trigger over being told take time off don't go to work for a week. But that's what happened to me, because not having that ability or understanding of mindfulness, I know how to accomplish a goal and get what I have to get done every day. I don't know, no one ever taught caregivers from my time period to step away and learn those skills. We didn't have that.
Sammy, I wonder if you think there's something also, I was just going back to something Sandra Luce said about military families being a tight unit, being people thinking like, I'm going to get through this no matter what. Do you think that there's something about that that would make people particularly both challenging to accept, but maybe to accept mindfulness, but also at the same time, maybe even more receptive to it? I wonder how you think people in a military situation might respond to something like this?
Right. I think for like Garrett and I would call it dangerous resilience, because the military did kind of ingrain in him and then me kind of by absorbing
what that culture.
That you just get through it. Whatever challenge is in front of you, it's the suck it up mentality and get to where you need to be the best way possible. And there wasn't any of this extra take care of yourself. Your inner being is important. I didn't realize I could get fatigued and have that reaction, because it was so strong. I feel so bad now for people who experience that on a regular basis.
Yeah.
It was really eye-opening, because that is like, it's scary.
It's debilitating.
Oh my gosh, yes.
I wonder also too, Sammy, when, again, like to my point about, we think a lot about how we can support veterans. Do you think we have enough conversations about how we could support the caregivers of veterans?
No.
I mean, what would you like to see? What kind of more conversations would you like to see around this?
Well, the way that the DOD and the Department of Veterans Affairs is set up is primarily to focus on the veteran. I completely understand that. But so much with these injuries coming back, because our medical care is phenomenal in combat zones, our injuries coming back are so significant. The resources for the family members taking care of that veteran, it's like a tiny percent of what the VA does.
Yeah, if I could just jump in. In fact, our preliminary research showed that there are very few services that actually match the needs of the caregivers. And so this was one of the impetus for this study, that we identified this huge gap in services, but also in providing some kind of resources that the caregivers would have at their disposal at all time, that they wouldn't have to call someone to help them, that they could then develop a whole new tool of resources that they could use on their own for the rest of their life.
Sandra Luce, so where do you want to go next with this research? What do you think needs to happen, especially as we're talking about helping folks like Sammy and her family?
Yeah, so I have submitted grant proposals to extend this work. I am working with other researchers in Chicago who are affiliated with the VA there, but also at the RAND Corporation where I used to work. I still have collaborators there. We are interested in launching this and making it a wider reach intervention, but also in identifying the needs that caregivers have. The research does show that there is a need, but we don't know specifically the type of services that they can benefit from. So we need to do that.
Right. So this initial research is really promising. Something I think really important and appropriate to think about as we head into the Memorial Day weekend. I want to thank Sammy Anderson for being with us, and Sandra Luce Lara Sinisomo. She teaches kinesiology, and she's a community health professor at the University of Illinois. We'll tweet out all of Sandra Luce's research as well for those of you who are interested in learning more about it. We'll have it up at our website at 21stshow.org as well. Sammy, Sandra Luce, thank you for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thanks so much for your time.
My pleasure.
Thanks for listening to this special encore edition of The 21st. That's all the time we have for today and for this week. I hope you're enjoying the 4th of July. Hopefully you have tomorrow off and it's a long weekend for you. On Monday, if you've ever opened up your local paper recently, chances are you've seen someone's mugshot. It's become a part of local crime reporting, but sometimes publishing those pictures can cause real harm. We'll be talking about that on Monday's show. Our Twitter handle is 21STShow. We live tweet during the program with more analysis and background about what we're talking about. You can also search for us on Facebook. It's a good way to comment on what we're working on or message us. All those links. Every way to contact us. If you'd like to leave us a voicemail, send us an email, or if you don't remember our social media handles, all you have to remember is our website. That's 21stshow.org. We've also got all of our past shows archived there, and you can find us most places you get your podcasts. We're on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, NPR One. Search for The 21st. We're produced by Libby Foster, Anna Casey, and Alan Montesilio, who's our senior producer. Eunice Alpasan and Jasper Davidoff are our interns. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Moore. Special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Have a great 4th of July. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for listening.